Hi, Harry.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Just fine, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being with us. I should tell people that you are Harry McCracken. And you are a quite noted tech nerd, if you don't mind my calling you that.
I wear it like a badge of honor.
Well, good. You should be proud of it. You started the blog Technologizer, and you were, before that, editor-in-chief of PC World for a while. And I have just lately been in the mood to talk technology. I mean, for one thing, I have some kind of consumer electronics purchasing decisions that maybe you can give me some guidance on at some point. But and they are actually related to some larger things that are going on in the world. The big kind of Google versus Apple showdown that we hear so much about in the realm of cell phones and maybe ultimately in the realm of tablets. And these kind of related questions, some of which have actual, I think, you know, political moment and cultural significance as well. Like, you know, is Steve Jobs starting to use his power to exercise censorship of a certain kind? Is he inflicting his design sensibility on the world, which is something I kind of have an issue with? I'm not a huge fan of his design sensibility. But anyway, and maybe we'll have time to talk about Facebook. That's a big issue, too. So with your permission, we can get started. Before we do, I wanted to say I only after arranging this dialogue did I do enough Googling of you to learn that you actually have a kind of an interesting history with Apple, which is that I think in 2007 you resigned as editor-in-chief of PC World because somebody at the company, you're one of your higher-ups at the company, killed an article that was critical of Apple, right?
Pretty much. I was told to spike a story. People always assume that computer magazines are in bed with their advertisers, and so I've always bent over backwards to prove that's not true. And I was lucky enough that I worked in the business for, you know, 15 years without ever being told to suppress anything. But I was told to spike a story, and I kind of felt like that was a line in the sand, and I resigned. And people can go online if they want to. They can probably dig up the whole story, but things worked out okay. I came back about a week later and worked another year at PC World, and we published the story.
And is but was Apple really? Did Apple advertise with PC World? I mean, PC World was like about Windows-based computers, right?
Yeah, I mean, I should make clear that Apple did not ask for anything to be spiked. It was more about concern that Apple might be upset after the fact.
They did advertise with PC World. Apple
They certainly have occasionally. One of the things about Apple's advertising is, I think they're much more interested in reaching out to people who haven't bought Macs yet, who represent 90% of the market. So magazines like PC World are of interest to them because of that.
Okay. Well, I wish we had enough advertising on Blogging Heads TV for me to demonstrate my independence, but offhand I can't. Well, actually, there have been Nexus One ads all over the web, including on Blogging Heads TV. So let me just say right now, I don't own a Nexus One. I own an iPhone. On the other hand, I have some issues with it, but we'll get to that. So what do you think? I mean, this is a really interesting time, isn't it, in technology? I mean, Steve Jobs rose from the dead, I mean, where he was kind of about 15 years ago. And now suddenly he's the guy. I mean, for a while it was Bill Gates who was going to take over the world. And then it was Google who was going to take over the world. And now he may take over the world, right?
This is really the most interesting time in technology, probably since the early 80s when PCs took off. Partially because mobile phones really are the new PC, and all the stuff that got thrashed out in the early 80s about what platforms would take over has been reset, and it is not clear whether the iPhone will dominate or Android or whether Microsoft will get back in the game. And there are these huge personality dynamics, and it kind of turns out, at least right now, Microsoft is sitting off on the side because they don't really have a mobile platform yet. They're basically starting over with Windows Mobile, but it won't be ready until the fall. And it really is about Google and Apple, and it really is sort of one of the fiercest wars we've seen in a while between two companies.
Yeah. And later I want to ask you if there's any hope whatsoever for Palm, but we'll get to that. It's interesting because, I mean, as you said, not only is the cell phone kind of the new computer platform, But with the advent of the tablet, it's looking like even, you know, I mean, even when it comes to laptop-sized computers, for a lot of people, the tablet may take the place of that. And who would have dreamed that, you know, you might wind up with a whole new war for the operating system that will control, you know, a laptop-sized computer, in effect, right? Because what Jobs has done is he's taken the cell phone operating system and he said, that, you know, the iPhone operating system, and said this is going to be the operating system on the tablet. And apparently that's appealing enough to people that now there will be these rivals. We think there will be Android-based tablets. Mm-hmm. HP may come out with a Palm-based or WebOS-based tablet, and so on. And that's just when did this become apparent to you? Nobody predicted this, right?
I don't think anybody saw any of this coming. I mean, it really sort of started about 3 years ago when Apple released the iPhone. And the most profound thing about the iPhone wasn't the hardware; it was the operating system, and it was something, you know, far more powerful and usable than any other phone operating system ever. And I think pretty quickly people started to talk about the notion of the iPhone operating system migrating up to devices. But until then, I mean, nobody really saw a way that Windows would not dominate computing devices for a long time to come.
Right. But here is the funny thing. Here is the funny thing, and I'm sure you've thought about this, is it could turn out that Steve Jobs is going to fail to adopt the strategy that Windows used to become the dominant operating system and is going to cling to the strategy that confined him to 5% or less of the PC, of the kind of PC market, so to speak. And you know what I mean, right? I mean, Windows said they licensed the software, so any hardware manufacturer could create a Windows-based computer. And the proliferation of options in the realm of hardware meant that a lot of that stuff got bought, and they came to, you know, I think that played a pretty big role in them dominating the market. And
totally.
Apple didn't do that, and Apple is once again not doing that. It's not letting anyone but itself make iPhones, and moreover, it's not even choosing to offer you several flavors like any that have a physical keyboard, right? And and meanwhile, Google is adopting what a kind of, except with less tight control of the operating system itself, but still, it is buying into an operating system that any manufacturer can build for, and it's starting to look to me like, well, there are issues, and we'll talk about those with the so-called fragmentation, but at the moment, it looks to me like Google may have the winning hand here. What do you think?
Well, Apple is being Apple. I really don't think it would be in their DNA to license their operating system and give up that control. One of the reasons that the iPhone is as good as it is because it's one of the few devices where one company controls the hardware, the software, and the service. And it just wouldn't be the same thing if they attempted to license it. We've already seen that with Android, which on some level is a pretty similar piece of software. But it has some of the issues that Windows always had in terms of reliability and simplicity, simply because Google doesn't even want to control it in the way that Apple dearly wants to control its products.
Right, and the analogy with Windows is a little imprecise, because Windows was Microsoft's product, and it tried to build a good product. I mean, Android is. You know, I would say it failed often, but Android is an open source system, and it's unclear to me how much control Google has, and there are already complaints that, I guess, because it's open source, you know, there are these various versions of Android out there. I mean, technically, they're just upgrades, right? They have, the latest is 2.2, but it seems like different phones are using different versions, and so That complicates things it's a complication that Google faces that Microsoft didn't face, right?
Google does not consider this to be fragmentation, because any two phones that run, say, Android 2.1 will run the same applications. But the issue is right now you have one Android phone that runs 2.2, You have a bunch that run 2.1. You have some that are on 1.6 and 1.5, and they're still all for sale. It's not that just that people who bought a phone a few months ago have an old version of the operating system. So some people who are buying phones right this very moment are using an old version, and some of the coolest apps won't run on the old software. I mean, I think Google kind of made matters worse because when they released Google Earth, which was, you know, one of the defining apps, they didn't make it work on most of the Android phones out there. They made it work only on Android 2.1, and when they did that, there was only one Android 2.1 phone. So Google, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think Google sees this as an issue at all. I was at their developer conference last week, and somebody asked about fragmentation, and they got a little huffy, and they said, this is not fragmentation, this is progress. But the end result is sort of the same if you buy a brand new phone and you can't run all the neatest Android applications.
Uh-huh. And why don't the phones, I mean, why are people still selling phones that have an older Android operating system? Is it because the handset manufacturers have kind of put on it an overlay interface that would not be readily compatible with the new Android?
I mean, I think the biggest issue is that phone companies move really slowly historically.
Yeah.
They've had a lot of time to build their products. They have to go through all of these FCC clearances, which take forever. They just are not used to the pace that a company like Google works at. And Google, I mean, it's fairly unusual for Google to release any kind of software. Google releases services, and when Google has new features, which it does more or less continuously, it's used to just rolling them out really quickly, and it can just flip a switch on its search engine, and the new features will be out there.
Uh-huh.
And it's taking a similar strategy with Android. And I also think they also really see themselves as being in a kind of almost a fight for survival with Apple and the iPhone, and they desperately want not only to catch up with the iPhone in every respect, but to be clearly enough ahead that they dominate.
Yeah. Well, do you mind if I do a little complaining about Steve Jobs' design sensibility?
Please do.
I guess my big complaint is, and this is becoming consequential, let me just say, because he's acquiring real power. I mean, just as Bill Gates, you know, it came to be the case that there was a whole lot of software out there that if you wanted access to it, you had to go through the Windows operating system. You know,
mm-hmm.
It was almost like, I mean, basically, if you wanted to live a modern life, you had to either go through Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. You had to put up with one of the operating systems, and there were a lot of programs that were only available through Gates. Well, now Jobs in the realm of cell phones is acquiring a version. You know, there's a lot of apps that are only available for the iPhone. So it's like you're kind of channeled into the world of Steve Jobs if you want certain kinds of apps. So he is powerful, and if you want to deal with him, like, you're stuck with this one phone. Of course, it famously doesn't have a tactile keyboard, and I won't belabor that point, although it does drive me a little nuts. But my big complaint about him is he emphasizes aesthetics over functionality, it seems to me. I mean, the iPhone itself is not an easy thing to hang on to. And you'd think, you know, in a cell phone, that's a desirable feature, the ability to hold it in your hand without dropping it. And as a result, because it's built like a bar of soap, you gotta, like, buy a thing, you know, a cover for it to make it grippable and to protect it both. And so that makes it big and unpocketable. But let me just say one more thing, and I'll let you chime in. An expression of his aesthetics of simplicity is his aversion to buttons. It took him forever to concede that a two-button mouse had something to be said for it, which is just obvious, you know, it seems to me, to anyone who's used one, that it's superior to one-button mouse. And on the iPhone, let me just contrast it. I mean, what bothers me is everyone has marched in lockstep. Everyone has decided he's right. Physical buttons are bad, you
mm-hmm.
know. And so it's hard to find an actual button that you can physically detect, right, on a phone. And the reason I hate this is back in the days of my Trio 650, you know, like a lot of people, I listened to MP3 files. and I'm walking around listening to an MP3 file. I may encounter someone I need to talk to. Someone may ask for directions. I may go into a store and buy something. It's convenient to be able to pause very easily. And with a Trio 650, I didn't have to take it out of my pocket. It had a button, you know, that you could use to pause the damn thing. In fact, with a 650, you could do volume up, volume down, pause, fast forward, and rewind without pulling it out of your pocket. But okay, I will I'll stop my rant now. I'm sure you've heard some of this stuff, but what's your view on Steve Jobs and design?
I mean, it is a complex question. Apple does not believe in a lot of choice. They would rather make fewer products and do them the way they want to, as opposed to, say, a company like HP, which makes computers at every price point from $300 to $3,000. The Apple products are in a narrow window, and there are not a lot of options. And that is certainly a challenge if you don't particularly want to do things the way Apple has chosen to do them. I think the whole question of buttons is interesting, though, because Android phones all have four buttons.
Although many of them are not tangible, kind of,
that's
right. They're flat, and you have to kind of see them to press them. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
If they were tactile, it would be better. But I mean, I use both phones almost every day. I own an iPhone and a Motorola Droid, partially because I write about both of them, but also because AT&T service in San Francisco is so poor in the areas I'm in. I need a Verizon phone for elsewhere. The iPhone is easier to use. It's quicker to get around, even though it only has one button, mainly because there's a lot of consistency. And if you want to look at a good thing about the Jobs aesthetic, is he's really good at consistency. And once you learn one iPhone application, the other ones tend to work in a very similar way. Google is not so good at consistency, and each application works a little bit differently. So some of them use the menu button, some don't. It's just a slower, more complex process in general. So it is a really complicated issue, and I think on balance, Steve Jobs is one of the few companies who doesn't particularly care to try to cater to the masses. And he doesn't necessarily want the iPhone to be dominant. I mean, even now,
you don't think so, really? I think he's bent on world conquest.
Well, maybe. I mean, the BlackBerry is the dominant best-selling phone in this country still to this day. Android is number two. The iPhone is number three, but because the price points are so high, it's making more money than anybody. And I think Steve Jobs wants to make the most profit. I'm not sure if he wants to sell the most devices, though, and there is a big difference.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess that would explain why he hasn't done a tactile. You know, it'd be the easiest thing in the world for him to have one of these slider phones where the keyboard slides out of the bottom. And he's so far has chosen not to, which is kind of shocking.
For a quarter century now, people have been saying that Apple should do something because it would be simple. That doesn't work with them. They'll do things the way that they think is best and see what happens. And usually, there are enough people who agree that it works. I mean, once in a great while, they do back down. I remember they took FireWire, which was a technology they invented, which competed with USB, but didn't do all that well in the market. Uh-huh. They did pull that out of some Macs, a couple of years ago, and there was a lot of angst over it. And that's one of the few cases where I remember where when the next round of new Macs came out, FireWire came back. But I'm not expecting to see a physical keyboard on an iPhone probably ever.
Yeah. And by the way, it seems to me that the reason that this unexpected, at least to me, thing is happening, that the cell phone operating system may migrate upward and become the tablet operating system, and the tablet may, for a lot of people, replace the computer. One thing that's appealing to that, but to tablets that are based on iPhone operating system, is precisely that consistency, right? It's that within any, you know, app or the equivalent of a computer program, there is a consistency of interface that makes any new app more readily learnable than a new computer program generally is. Would you say that's true?
I mean, that's certainly part of that. And Apple did something which nobody ever did over the last 20 years. There's this rich history of companies trying to build tablets.
Uh-huh.
Apple's the first company that actually built a user interface for a tablet computer. About 10 years ago, Microsoft started saying that the tablet PC would be the dominant computing platform, but they didn't build a new interface. They basically took Windows and slapped on some some stuff to let you do it. Apple came much closer to starting from scratch, and I think that's the reason why the iPad is doing as well as it is because simply they designed a user interface, which nobody bothered to do before.
Now, what about these issues of Jobs using his power in an actually politically consequential way, the so-called censorship issues? You know, famously, they turned down apps kind of based on, you know, content sometimes, and there was this cartoonist, and they said, no, no, political cartoons of this sort are too dicey. You can't have your app on our machine. But then the guy won the Pulitzer Prize, and they said, okay, maybe you can. What do you think about that?
I mean, that profoundly bothers me, especially with the iPad coming out and the notion that this will be a major way that we consume books and magazines from now on. Political candidates have also run into trouble. I mean, there's been talk of magazines basically needing to cover up cheesecake photos and so forth because they won't fly on the iPhone and the iPad. And they did a Apple went through and they threw out a bunch of PG-rated applications, which they had accepted originally. One of the big problems is the inconsistency of this all. They'll accept stuff and they'll throw it out, or they'll reject it and then accept it. And the one thing which almost nobody ever brings up, which confuses me to this day, is Apple is the number one seller of digital music in the world, and they don't seem to censor there. In fact, they have music by bands with names that they would not allow to be used in an iPhone application, and that seems to work for them. They'll publish the music people want to do and not try to be in charge of good taste, but they're not doing that with applications. For some reason, that's different.
Well, that's funny. You probably read this little item. I think it was somebody who writes for Gizmodo or something who got in an email exchange with Steve Jobs, and Jobs said, the guy was complaining about this very issue, like, where's the freedom? And Jobs said, well, the iPad gives you other kinds of freedom, like freedom from pornography. Did you read about that exchange?
Yeah, that was Ryan Tate from Ballywag who went through that conversation.
Okay.
And Jobs several times has talked about if you want porn, get an Android, and if you don't want porn, get an iPhone. He keeps coming back to that.
Well, it's funny. At first, I was really struck by how kind of like just old and conservative it made him sound. But then I realized, you know, as a parent, I'm starting to see what he may be onto. I mean, this could have considerable appeal to a lot of parents. I mean, my kids are beyond the age of control. They're like teenagers. But it's true that you know, a tablet with apps. Of course, if the browser is working on the tablet, then you have access to everything. But a parent has the power, no doubt, to disable the browser, confine it to apps, and then they can hand their 7, 9, 11-year-old kid a computer that has all the email and a whole bunch of computer functionality, but does not make it very easy to stumble upon, a hardcore porn site, for example. So don't you think marketing-wise he could conceivably... although come to think of it, Wait, I take that all back. Never mind. Because the parents, obviously, if they could control the app downloading process, they could just choose the damn apps and Steve Jobs wouldn't have to do the filtering for them, right?
And I mean, there are parental controls, so you can lock down an iPhone or an iPad. So it only does G-rated stuff.
Yeah.
But if you do that, the browser is going to be a problem because a kid who wishes to is going to be able to find stuff on via the browser, even if the apps are squeaky clean.
Yeah. So come to think of it, maybe I don't understand exactly what he's up to, unless maybe he himself has truly become conservative in his late middle age.
It's a little puzzling. I mean, part of the issue is that Apple is the sole source for getting applications. If there was the official iPhone app store and unofficial third-party ones, we wouldn't have a problem here because Apple could distribute the apps it wanted to, and ones it didn't want to distribute would still be available.
Uh-huh.
But unless you jailbreak your iPhone, you're stuck with what Apple chooses to give you. And for whatever reason, he's way more conservative with applications than he is with music or movies.
Uh-huh. Now, do you think, I mean, I, you know, I've been a journalist all my life. I've made a living writing, and that's become very difficult, or more difficult lately, because, as you know, content seems to want to be free. And do you think that the combination of the cell phone, you know, the computer type cell phone, and you know, smartphone, and the tablet are going to resurrect the possibility of actually making a living by generating content?
You know, we'll see. There are some reasonably interesting digital magazines and digital newspapers for the iPad, and people are downloading them and paying for them right now, and I think there still is a novelty effect because this whole idea is so new.
Yeah.
It's still a little unclear to me if a company keeps its website free, which will typically have everything in the magazine app, plus
right.
a lot more. It's unclear to me why you would pay for the application. I also kind of feel like, while people probably are willing to pay for content, it is in the nature of human beings who are not journalists or media moguls that if it's digital, it should cost at least somewhat less. And so when a magazine like Wired or Time wants to charge exactly the same as the cover price at the newsstand, I feel like a little price break would make a big difference because people immediately think that when you throw away having to print magazines and put them in trucks and send them out to newsstands, you're saving a ton of money, and some of that should be passed on.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. You know, I will say on the question of, you know, if you've got the website, why use the app? I will say that on the iPhone at least, I would rather read the New York Times on the iPhone app than on the web. It's because, for one thing, you know, it downloads in the background, so you can be on a subway or whatever. You know, you don't have to have ongoing wireless.
That's true.
But also, it's just a really sweet little interface, and that's related to the fact that you don't download it article by article. The responsiveness of it makes it a really efficient way to read the newspaper.
The Times has done some of the nicest interfaces on this. I mean, their iPad app has this weird issue that it seems to include only about 1% of the newspaper content. But it has one of the best user interfaces by far.
I think that's apparently because of some contractual relationship with Amazon that or something, isn't it?
Supposedly,
that precludes
yeah.
the Times from...
Supposedly. I mean, I would cheerfully pay the Times pretty much as I would pay for a print newspaper on the iPad if
mm-hmm.
I got all the content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I'm skeptical of the ability of, like, a lot of magazines to resurrect themselves via a tablet app, you know? Because it seems to me that what's kind of hurting magazines is the ease of moving, you know, from site to site. It's the very idea of a single coherent product edited by, you know, with a single sensibility, you know, the problem. I mean, am I making any sense? You know what I mean?
Totally. I mean, they're trying to resurrect the idea that you sit down with one publication and spend
right.
quality time with it and don't jump off to their competitors several times in the process.
Right.
Because most of these digital magazines, I mean, they don't link to the web at all. So far, they don't really try to get you to start pushing out the stuff you like to Facebook or Twitter. It's kind of a more solitary experience, which in a lot of ways is nice, actually. But it's unclear whether real people want to go back to that or not, or whether people have gotten into the web mode, which is infinitely richer, even if it sort of hurts the idea that you have an attention span when you're consuming content.
Yeah. I mean, it is, though. I mean, I find often when I'm deprived of alternatives, you know, when I'm not on the web, you know, it's sometimes a better life, you know? I mean, it's like I'm able to focus on actually writing an email and, mm-hmm. you know, so that when I get to the difficult part of the email and I don't know what to say, you know, I don't have the option of just going off to the web and diverting myself, you know? I mean, sometimes I feel I almost would pay for someone to preclude alternatives.
I think it works great for books. You know, when I am reading a book by an interesting author, I am very happy with the notion of focusing my attention on what that person has to say for an extended time. I do think magazines and news-related things are a little bit different because those tend to be part of a conversation on topics of the day, and it's a little bit more of a challenge to be isolated and still be interesting compared to a book.
Right, and of course there's the fact that they often online have hyperlinks in them that, you know.
I really want to see these things succeed, partially because they're interesting and because I have a vested interest in the idea that journalists will be able to make money. But every so often I ask my readers about whether they want to pay for content, and it's generally about 75% no, not under any circumstances.
That's disturbing. But you guys are doing okay at Technologizer?
So far, so good.
Advertising only is your model, an ad-based revenue model.
Essentially, it's almost completely advertising, and so our challenge is to get enough readers to scale up to make that possible. And to leverage the fact that our overhead is extremely low.
Well, and the fact that you're talking, you know, the subject of your journalism is pricey devices, right?
It happens to be a good topic for a website because there are millions of people who are deeply interested in it, and there are also a lot of large companies who are very interested in reaching those people through advertising. Mm-hmm. It's technology products are one of the largest advertising markets there are on the web.
Yeah. I would think. Do you know if in the ads that if I go to Technologizer, do you know to what extent the ads I'm shown there are informed by data about my own browsing history?
Very little. I mean, essentially, for the most part, the ads you see are ones which happen to be part of campaigns that tech companies purchased, so they're not targeting you so much as targeting Technologizer readers.
Don't you think that maybe the hope for an ad-based revenue model is in what some people would consider an invasion of privacy, but looked at in another way, is just using more information about the consumer, about those browsing habits, you know, so that if I've been Googling for about the Palm Pre, I'm shown an ad for a Palm Pre. In theory, that could definitely add to the ad revenue, right? Doing more of that.
I mean, in theory, it's good for everybody. If I can say to an advertiser, here's somebody who we know is interested in the Palm Pre, they'll pay more for that ad. And in theory, if you are indeed interested in the Palm Pre, you would prefer to see an ad for the Palm Pre than for some other phone, which you would never buy in 100 years. And that theory has been around for as long as there's been a web. And I mean, I think there have been technical challenges. There are certainly major, major challenges with convincing real people that that's a good idea, because people very quickly get very huffy about the notion of this data being used, even if it would sort of result in advertising that was more relevant to them.
Yeah, and in fact, isn't Google, out of sensitivity to those concerns, actually choosing not to use all the data it has in selling ads?
Google could certainly do a lot more than it does. I mean, I have my Google history feature turned on, which means that every single thing I've done on Google over the last several years, I can go back and see, and it is a pretty rich vein of information about me. And Google does use some of that information to target me, but it tends to be a little more transient.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to remember something I did a year ago and target me. It's more about what I've done right that very moment.
So you must lead a pretty clean life if you're willing to leave that feature on.
Well, I find it to be fascinating. I mean, I kind of feel like if there are things that you don't want the world to know about or don't want Google to know about, just don't do them online at all. I have the same philosophy about Facebook. Don't get concerned about Facebook sharing stuff you don't want shared. Just don't put it in Facebook in the first place, if that's your concern, because even if Facebook doesn't share it with the world, if you're sharing it with a small circle of friends, they're going to get access to it, and they could share it.
Yeah. You want to talk about Facebook a little? It's really, lately, of course, Mark, is it Zuckerberg? Is that his last name? The founder, very young founder in, of Facebook, did a mea culpa recently because well, why don't you describe? You know better than I do the background for this.
Well, Facebook just a few weeks ago had its big developer conference, and the big news was essentially they were going to get way more serious about sharing information across the web. I mean, they sort of wanted to move the whole Facebook model across every site it could, which is why like buttons started appearing everywhere, including on Technologizer.
Yeah.
You know, I very quickly added this feature where if you can like something and your Facebook friends will see what you liked. They also did deals with Pandora and Microsoft, among other companies, to essentially share information about things like my musical tastes with Pandora. So when I arrived at Pandora, I would play songs I might like. And Facebook made a number of mistakes. I mean, they kind of have a history of breaking things, catching a lot of flack, and then fixing it afterwards. And they did things which they still have not changed, such as automatically sharing this information with sites like Pandora. You can opt out of that, but it is opt out, not opt in. And Facebook's privacy features are kind of remarkable. They're actually quite powerful. There are dozens of settings to such an extent that unless you are deeply interested in diving in, it is really hard to figure them out. And they almost make you feel powerless rather than powerful just because it is so convoluted.
And what is the default position? I'm on Facebook. I don't actually go there very often, but I'm there. And I haven't bothered with these privacy settings at all. Does that mean that I have the minimal possible privacy or the maximum possible privacy? What is the default condition if you don't fiddle with them?
I mean, that's another issue because it keeps changing. And sometimes things that were private, Facebook decides to make public. So you can make no changes to your settings and find that things that were private have become public. And it's just kind of confusing. And even, yesterday they announced they are doing some changes, including making things simpler. But even that post, which Mark Zuckerberg wrote, is a pretty dense document. And it starts out with a history of privacy on Facebook and uses some terms like platform, which I don't think ordinary people use when they talk about Facebook. And it still feels kind of complicated to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And it's this complexity almost as much as anything they're doing that I think is an issue, because there are actually many companies on the web that have far less interest in privacy than Facebook does.
Yeah.
But because, I mean, if Facebook was a country, it would be the third largest country on Earth, and so they're always going to be at the center of the storm. And
Not
terribly good at PR in terms of making people happy with this stuff.
And I would say deservedly at the center of the storm in the sense that they have more of a stranglehold over us than Steve Jobs has. I mean, the fact is, iPhones, if there are certain apps, if you want them, you got to go to the iPhone, and a lot of apps maybe, but fact is you can have the functional rough equivalent of the iPhone in a lot of ways. With Facebook, there's nothing else, right? But because the whole key to Facebook is that everyone you might want to be friends with is on Facebook, and there's no other country like that for Americans, right? I mean, in some other literal physical countries, there are alternatives to Facebook that are dominant, but in America, there is no escape unless you want to just not do that kind of online exercise, right?
That's right. I mean, for a while, it looked like it was going to be a race between Facebook and MySpace. But Facebook took off and MySpace faltered. And so there really is nothing else. There's LinkedIn for business-related networking, but in terms of your whole life, there really is nothing else that is up there. We're seeing Google try to tippy-toe into that area, but their big effort so far has been Google Buzz, which ran into a lot of privacy-related issues of its own.
Yeah, their debut was a disaster. You were included in Buzz by default or something, right? And they did a terrible job of the default settings,
right? I mean, their bright idea was that they would build Buzz, which is a little bit like Twitter, into Gmail, so it would be right in your face all the time. It wouldn't be a separate service. And they discovered pretty quickly that people didn't want to have that turned on by default and be part of their Gmail experience. And you didn't necessarily want your contacts in Gmail, which historically have been kind of private, to suddenly become this public network that other people could check out. And in fact, a lot of people have contacts in their email life that they specifically don't want other people to know that they're talking to.
Totally. Kind of obvious. It's amazing how seemingly arrogant some of these, or just thoughtless or something, some of these companies are.
It's pretty amazing. But they're both full of smart people. And in both cases, in rather similar ways, they just completely misjudged what the public response would be.
Is it too crazy to say that one? I mean, let me do some Windows dissing while I'm at it as a preface to this question. I mean, Windows. I mean, Microsoft, strictly speaking. I mean, I just think Microsoft has consistently demonstrated no comprehension of human beings, human nature, and you know, I just think. I will say, I think Steve Jobs is a better designer, even on functional grounds, than Microsoft. And one little thing, I have bought a number of, but for blogging heads, trying to find a good webcam, I bought several Microsoft-branded webcams. One thing they all have in common, I wish I could show you the webcam I'm using now. It's the one I use on the road. I'm in San Francisco now. But, of course, to use the webcam to show you the webcam would violate some sort of metaphysical principle, so I won't. Mm-hmm. But it's like you can't – they make it impossible to attach them to anything. I mean, mine has a little track where if it so happened that I was using a laptop that was exactly 7, you know, millimeters wide in the edge, you could fit this thing on and I could put it on the top of my laptop. But 98% of laptops are not going to work with this. There's no flexibility built into it. I've seen this time and again in Microsoft branded webcams. I'll stop now and try to remember what I was going to say. Oh, I know what I was going to say. But meanwhile, have you run into this problem with webcams at all? Maybe not.
Well, lately I've been using webcams built into computers, so I haven't run into it lately. I mean, I do have a lot of concerns about a world where Steve Jobs dominates what tech we use, but at least the products are going to be a lot better designed than they have been over the last couple of decades, where Microsoft really was the defining company. Microsoft occasionally gets things right, but it's not in their DNA to make things that are usable.
And the question I was going to ask, I mean, given that all the Google and Facebook, Microsoft, in their own ways, seem to do these kinds of ham-handed things that it turns out human beings don't like, is it crazy to suggest that there's, these companies tend to be dominated by kind of engineers, you know, kind of tech people. And according to stereotype, you know, these are not the people who would be working a room at a cocktail party in especially fluid fashion, right? I mean, is there something about techies that makes them kind of sometimes not get human nature well enough to design good products? Or is that just a sort of horrible stereotyping I'm engaging in?
It's a horrible stereotype, but I think it's largely true. I mean, obviously, Microsoft was defined by Bill Gates' sensibility, and he's a technical whiz, not a usability expert. Google, to some extent, is somewhat similar. That's also a company run by nerds. And, you know, Steve Jobs is not really a nerd. When the Apple II came along, he did not design the Apple II. That was Steve Wozniak who did it. Jobs is really much more a person who is interested in marketing, clearly, and also usability and sort of human factors. And I think that is one reason why Apple has been doing well lately. I think it's partially just because it is sort of refreshing after 20 years of Windows to use products that don't have horrible security issues you need to worry about every time you turn on your computer, and reliability issues and bizarre error messages as one of the defining features of the platform. It is kind of refreshing to see computer products that actually work fairly well.
Yeah, my favorite error message is the one that I think stuck around at least through Windows 98, where it would say permanent fatal error. I mean, first of all, it's like as if fatal isn't bad enough, it's permanently fatal as opposed to being temporarily fatal, right? But secondly, it's like, when you're having a tough day, like you're on deadline or something, your computer crashes. I mean, you just really don't need to see words like fatal, right?
There's stuff they don't get. Another thing, speaking of trying to get work done, you know, Windows has a Windows Update, which is downloading patches and updates. And to this day, it will automatically reboot your computer, and there's literally no way to prevent it from doing that. Oh. And it may well happen when you're desperately trying to finish an important document, and you may, in fact, lose that document. I don't think Microsoft gets why this is a basic problem and something they clearly should not be doing. The interesting thing about both the iPad and the iPhone is they almost don't have error messages. They actually are not perfectly reliable. That when something goes wrong, the application just disappears and it doesn't explain to you what went wrong. And that's almost a better experience than error messages, given that 99% of error messages are not helpful.
I know at least one dialogue has been lost to the very feature of Windows you just described. I will say, though, that Windows 7 seems to me like not that bad, right? What do you think?
Windows 7 is the best version of Windows in a long time, partially because Microsoft has always set a horrible example for software companies because it spent so much time popping up messages in your face and it believed people wanted to have a talking paperclip help them out with Office and a little dog help them search in Windows. And it was did so much in-your-face stuff. And Windows 7, the single best thing about it is they just pulled way back on that, and it's less obtrusive, and you can actually focus on getting stuff done. And they did a really nice job with that. I mean, it is, it's really nice, and it's at least as a small sign of progress on their part.
Would you say that it's almost comparable to the Apple operating system? I mean, Apple, by virtue of having a much smaller share of the market, is by virtue of that alone less vulnerable to viruses, because virus designers, you know, aim high. But would you say that aside from that, Windows 7 is really not that far from the current Apple's Mac operating system?
The gap is certainly way smaller than it's been a long time. Apple also builds the computer and decides exactly what software is on it, and Microsoft doesn't have that privilege.
Right.
It's on computers of all sorts, and in certain cases, a computer manufacturer will kind of mess up Windows 7. In that sense, Microsoft can't control things as much as it might like to.
Okay. I want to ask you one more Facebook question and then finally get some guidance with a purchasing decision I have coming up, and then I'll let you go. You know, Facebook, I think one reason Zuckerberg has been kind of ham-handed in a couple of – there have been a couple of cases, the famous Beacon case and so on, where he kind of went too far and there was a lot of blowback. One reason he can get away with it is because, as we said, he's just the only game in town. Like, where are you going to go? And now you've started to read lately about people trying to start rivals. And it's not obvious to me that it's even it's conceivable that at this point anybody, you know, can get traction in this field, right? Do you think it's possible that a rival to Facebook could really take shape?
Yes, but it might take a really, really long time because, like you say, I'm not going to leave Facebook for an alternative unless the majority of my friends and family do, too. It's kind of pointless to try to start a new social network. So,
right.
I mean, monopolies do end. A lot of the Microsoft monopolies are either crumbling or starting to look weak, but in most of those cases, it took 10 to 15 to 20 years, and with Facebook, it might be the same thing.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's some kind of vulnerability that arises from Facebook kind of, well, I didn't even know enough about it, but, you know, the way it's letting various websites and so on kind of plug into and various apps plug into its database to some extent, I guess. I was wondering if that would allow some rival to kind of parasitize it in some way, but maybe not.
Well, the one thing that Facebook doesn't really let those sites do is grab all my relationships. Facebook controls those pretty carefully, and it's pretty obvious why. It's if they give those up, they're giving up the thing that makes them as important as they are.
That is the ranch. Okay, so finally, Palm Pre Plus. I have to admit that, I mean, it's like I should seek therapy. I have really kind of fallen in love with the Palm Pre Plus. I mean, it has issues, it has downsides. I won't get into those, but the operating system, I just think is a thing of beauty. I really like a tactile keyboard. Honestly, I don't think I've had a crush on anything like this since, before I was married. I mean, it's really kind of embarrassing. I really want the phone, but, you know, there's, it would take, you know, it's all about the apps to a considerable extent. You want a phone with a broad variety of apps, especially as new apps come along. And it's going to take a kind of a miracle comeback, even though HP, with all its marketing clout, has bought Palm, for the Palm Pre to get back in the game, I think, right? So what should I do?
Well, I mean, the Palm Pre Plus is a really nice phone. It's been a favorite of mine since it came out. And it's arguably is the best operating system at all. I think you can make the case that the Palm's WebOS is the best mobile operating system right now. And it was therefore pretty surprising to me that the phone has not really taken off. I don't think you need 200,000 applications to be happy. You just need the handful that you need. And so the bar is not quite as high for the Pre to be useful to you. And in general, the quality of the apps is quite high on the Pre. I'd say they're probably in a lot of cases higher than on Android, where they tend to be a little inconsistent and patchy. I give HP maybe about a 30% chance of pulling off making WebOS powerful for them.
That's a higher than average estimate, right? Most people aren't saying 30%.
30% means I'm an optimist on this stuff because it's a huge challenge. HP is one of the largest companies in this industry, which for several decades has let Microsoft make all the decisions about the software, and they're going to try to do the whole thing in the way that Apple does. And there are other examples, such as Palm, of companies trying to do things the Apple way and failing. But I'm sort of optimistic, and I would buy a Pre. I mean, I think on Verizon, the phone itself is $30, which is ridiculously cheap, and it comes for free with Wi-Fi tethering, so you can use the phone.
Well, it's beyond Wi-Fi tethering. You can tether five computers to it at once, I think.
It's an amazing deal. It's a really nice phone. It has a decent, although small, selection of apps. So I think if you're in love with that, you should go for it.
God bless you, Harry McCracken. That's so much what I want to hear. I will say I personally think the way that HP could make it work is with a kind of a hybrid of the Apple and Microsoft scenarios. I think they need to convince application makers very, very, very soon that they're seriously in the game. And I think the way to do that is just find one major handset maker and do a deal with them and announce it, where that handset maker is going to build three phones over the next, you know, whatever. And in addition, HP is planning to build so many phones, you know, convince people that there's going to be an abundance of handsets out there. In fact, I think if Palm had licensed its operating system with, say, Motorola when the Pre came out, or somebody who was searching, you know, one of these handset makers that was searching and turned it into a big deal, I think you'd have a whole different story now, because I think you'd have five times as many apps.
In retrospect, that would have been a better strategy, and I think HP sort of has to wait until it actually owns Palm, which it doesn't quite yet, to start talking about some of that stuff, but it is going to be fascinating to see what its strategy is, and my sense is that they are serious about this.
Go ahead, sorry.
There are a lot of other examples of companies buying operating systems in the past and then sort of giving up almost immediately, but my sense is that HP wants to control its destiny in a way it can't if Microsoft or Google controls the operating system.
Yeah. Well, I wish it well. I think I am going to get one of these, the Pre Plus from AT&T probably. And I will hold you accountable for the results.
Let me know how it goes.
But listen, thanks for being my my tech nerd advisor.
My pleasure. Anytime, Bob.
And congratulations on Technologizer's success.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll link to it and send people there.
Sounds great.
Maybe we can do one of these again sometime.
I would absolutely love that.
Okay. See you, Harry.
Thanks, Bob. Bye-bye.